This is Read On Air with Red Zell. For those passionate about books.
Hello and welcome to Read On Air, the show all about books that belongs to you. I'm your host, Red Zell, and this week we're talking to some top authors who have not allowed sight loss to stand in the way of their success. Crime writer Mark Hardy explains how blindness doesn't stop him from describing a murder scene.
If we're near something that I want to describe, I'll actually go and feel it, much to her embarrassment.
Harriet Lane reveals how sight loss enabled her to become an author.
I think I was hopeful, I was fearful, because I suspected maybe I wouldn't be able to do it. I just needed somewhere, I think, to try and write again.
International best-selling writer Joanna Trollope tells Leanne why she's such a passionate supporter of talking books. And I dust off a gem by a writer who lost his sight when his brother shot him with an arrow. That's all coming up on today's show. Mark Hardy is an author with a backstory. He only took up writing after losing his sight completely in 2002. His first book, Burned and Broken, was snapped up by a major publishing house and has drawn comparisons with other crime writers such as Peter Robinson and Ian Rankin. It's a gritty, gripping police procedural set in the Essex town of Southend-on-Sea, a place where hope seems to have receded with the tide. The follow-up, Truly Evil, is published in August, just in time for the summer holidays. This time, D.S. Frank Pierce and D.C. Cat Russell are called up to investigate a body on a beach and drawn into a terrifying cover-up going back 50 years. Mark Hardy, welcome to Read On Air.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, I believe you only became a writer when you finally lost all your sight in 2002.
That's right. Before I lost my sight, I was working as a computer consultant, running my own business in the City of London. And then I lost my sight and I started an open university course, which was actually in history. But I found that wasn't very interesting. So I looked around for creative writing courses and I was surprised to find that the Open University did one. So I went on that and I really enjoyed it. And I was getting very good feedback from my tutor. So I thought, hey, I might have a talent for this, or, you know, might be able to go a bit further with it. But I didn't think at that time that I was going to necessarily have anything published. It was just really for my own satisfaction that I was doing it.
I must say, as somebody who is blind and a writer myself, the challenges of actually editing your own work sometimes are quite insuperable. How do you go about writing and editing your work?
I always use a computer. I learnt to touch type, and I use a screen reader. I actually use JAWS at the moment, and I use that via Microsoft Word. The editing process is very tough, so I write a chapter at a time into a Word document, and then if I'm needing to copy or, you know, edit large paragraphs or large chunks of text, I usually copy them into a different document, edit them in there, and then paste them back in. So it'll generally turn out to be quite a messy way of doing it, and very cumbersome, but it's the best way I've found so far.
And I mean, a bit like Morecambe and Wise, you cannot see the join in your writing. Your writing is very, very fluid. I found myself marvelling at how well it flows. Do you have somebody read it over to you afterwards, a proper human voice rather than the JAWS voice?
I don't have somebody read it back to me as such. No, I listen to it on JAWS. I've got a synthetic voice, not the, you know, the Stephen Hawking type original voice. So I use, I think it's RealSpeak I use at the moment. But I listen to it back, but I do have a number of readers who read it in the text form and then comment on it. And it goes through various stages to get through to the, you know, the polished product. But not, they don't really read it back to me as such, but I think the JAWS voice is not ideal, but it's quite good. And when it actually comes through to the audio production, side of it right at the end, and you've got a human narrator. I think that really adds to it. That really sort of reinforces to me that I know where I'm going, and I can almost hear the voices, the dialogue.
It certainly shows, and actually, I was going to ask you about your ear for dialogue. It's spot on. I spent a fair amount of time in Southend over the years, and I could imagine myself walking along the seafront and listening to some of those voices pouring out of the nightclub. I think it was Tots in my day, but
I think it may still be there. I'm not sure about that.
But how do you do your visual research? Because many of the passages are very descriptive. Do you just have a very good memory for what you used to be able to see?
I suppose that's part of it. You know, I lost my sight 15 years ago now, but you sort of view everything through a haze of nostalgia, so things that were mundane to you at the time that you could see, you know, puddles and, you know, the mud flats and the grey sky. Now, because you're looking back on them in almost a romantic way, you can sort of conjure that vision back in a very sort of rich way. But I usually go out to a scene that I want to describe with my wife, and I'll stand there and listen to the sounds, get the smells and get the atmosphere of it, and I think that comes quite across in the description. And then it may be an area that I have visited before and I could see, or it may not, but I'll get my wife to describe certain things, and I'll say, you know, what colour is it, what type of colour is it, and what's the texture. And if we're near something that I want to describe, I'll actually go and feel it, much to her embarrassment.
So there was a palm tree that you went and hugged, rather like your character.
I did actually do that. My wife was quite embarrassed at the time.
So it makes a change to embarrassing your children, I suppose, which is what I normally do.
Oh, I do that as well. And my grandchildren.
Oh, brilliant. And the police procedural aspects are spot on. I know a woman who used to be a detective in a major incident team in London, and I passed her your book, and she said they were absolutely spot on. Are you just very good at your research? Or
I've actually got a powers of police advisor, so I write, you know, I think of the scenario, and I think of it, how would I investigate it as a reasonably intelligent person, and I have a crack at doing it. And then I'll pass it over to Phil and say, he was luckily enough an ex-DCI in the major incident team in Essex. So I'll say to him, how would you have gone about investigating this crime? Can you give me any little pointers, little tips, little things that police, you know, might say, their attitudes, how they would speak to each other? I think that's quite an important part of the whole thing as well. So I do have expert advice once I've had a go at trying to write it myself.
Are you a big crime fan anyway? Was that the type of fiction that you felt drawn to write?
I've been asked this before, and yes and no. I sort of alternate between crime fiction and literary fiction, to be honest. But I'll often read a crime fiction book and think, well, you know, the plot was okay, but the characters were a bit shallow, or, you know, there wasn't a lot of depth to anything other than the storyline. And then I'll read maybe a literary fiction book and think, you know, the prose is beautiful, the characterisation is fantastic, but what actually happened at the end of it? You know, nothing's moved on, nothing's resolved. The characters haven't had their journey, you know, for want of a better phrase. So I do sort of alternate between it, but I would say I probably, if anything, I lean more to literary fiction. But to me, a good book is a good book, and usually that's something, a book that's well written, and you can actually tell by reading it that the author's put a lot of time and effort into writing it, and that's all I look for really in a book.
I like the surrealist touches that you certainly brought to Burnt and Broken, and that I'm hoping are going to surface again in Truly Evil. The different way that different people can see the world around them. You and I both know that if you are blind, you see the world in quite a different way to those who are sighted. Did you feel that that was an important element to bring into your books?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Maybe it's treated in a slightly different way in Burned and Broken, but obviously, as soon as you lose your sight, your perception of the world is different from other people's, and I think everyone's got their own different view of the world and people. You might meet people and say, oh, well, he was quite nice, and then, you know, whoever we've seen, well, I didn't like him. You know, and they'll pick up on something. Mm-hmm. I didn't like the way he talked. I didn't like his mannerisms, or, you know, he was a bit patronising, or, you know, something like that. So I think that was quite a good driver towards the book. One of the narratives in the book is the detective inspector who gets killed very early on.
Mm.
And the whole one of the premises of the book is that the older male detective and the younger female detective have got very different views of him. And as the book progresses, both of their views change. But as their views change, we get an insight into their characters as well. But on the other side of it, the more surrealist side, I don't know what other blind people see, but people have got the idea that, you know, it's darkness, it's blackness. What I actually see is patterns of light all the time and shifting light, and it's quite disturbing to me, and it's something that I've struggled to get used to over, you know, 15 years, and I wanted to sort of portray that, and I think the best way to come across that is to do something where the actual person who's involved has got a very different perception of the world. So I thought about one of the characters is on the spectrum of schizophrenia.
Mm-hmm.
So and schizophrenics see quite different view of the world. They'll see rats, or they'll see, you know, and there was a good program on Horizon recently, and they were talking to a schizophrenic person, and he was on antipsychotic drugs at the time, so he'd already been medicated, but he was talking to his psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist said, what's wrong? And he said, I can see a crab. There's a giant crab sitting next to you, next to the printer. And so that idea of somebody seeing that as an absolute reality when it's something completely different to what other people see was quite interesting to me. And that is obviously viewed through the prism of a different perception of the way you see the world when you do become blind.
Yeah, absolutely. I sometimes feel that I'm sitting in one of those 1960s drug films with the flashing lights and the sort of bending colours. It is quite disturbing. And I thought, you know, the way you captured how the schizophrenic character is haunted by shapes that she can't interpret, or figures that seem to come out of the mirror. It was spot on. Are you a keen audiobook user then?
Yes, I listen to. I've always got a book on the go, and it's probably where I get my main interest outside of writing is actually reading or listening to music. So yes, I've always got an audiobook on the go, and I've probably got one ready to go after that as well.
I find it one of the few compensations of being blind is that actually, just like in childhood, somebody's reading to me nowadays. And certainly the audiobook version of Burned and Broken is very powerfully read. You must have been pleased to have heard it.
I was absolutely delighted when I listened to it. And actually, there was a very long process to go about to get the reader that we decided on at the end. Once again, Little Brown Sphere were very supportive in that, and we actually spoke about the narrator for the audio book in the very first meeting that I had with them. But it was a very long process because I had a very particular tone of voice in mind. I wanted him to be, having listened to so many audiobooks, I wanted a particular delivery, you know, not as if somebody's reading a book to me, but as if they're actually there, they're telling you the story, or, you know, in a way they're acting out the story for you. So it's almost, they're narrating a book, but it's dramatised as well. So, and I wanted a very specific tone and atmosphere, which I described to them as sort of like a film noir voiceover, but done in a London accent. So I didn't sound too much of a challenge. And they came up with quite a lot of different people, and I was saying to them, no, he's too posh. No, he's too... He reads, that sounds like a book. No, he's not. He's too dramatic. He's not dramatic enough. And, you know, I was getting a lot of emails back saying, no, don't apologise. We're glad that you're so engaged with the process, and we're always up for a challenge and all this sort of thing. I think they really were just saying to me, you're a pain in the backside. So,
well, it came good in the end. Rupert Holiday Evans really nails it, doesn't he?
He does. I think I was absolutely delighted when I heard the audio, and I've just actually heard the audio for Truly Evil, and that is as good, if not better.
That's him again, is it?
It is him, yeah. If the series continues, then Rupert will continue to narrate it for me.
Truly Evil, which is being published, I believe, in August, in time for the summer holidays.
As far as I know, yes, it's scheduled for the 10th of August in audio, and once again in braille and large print, I hope.
Which is fantastic to know that it's being simultaneously published so that blind and sighted readers can have the benefit of reading it at the same time.
Yeah, it's great. I think they're very supportive, Sphere Little Brown, in doing that. So it's very good news for me as well.
Well, the more publishers who follow suit, the better. And I know what my holiday reading is going to be. It's going to be Truly Evil.
Thank you very much.
Well, Mark Hardy, thank you so much for coming on to the programme. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you, and I wish Truly Evil all the very best of luck.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks again, Mark. Truly Evil will be published simultaneously in hardback and as an audiobook on the 10th of August, and in other alternative formats from RNIB. And if you want to read the first book in a series that I expect will join Morse, Rebus and Banks on our TV screens, then Burned and Broken, read by Rupert Holiday Evans, is TB23237. But be warned, it does contain some strong language.
RNIB. Supporting people with sight loss.
The RNIB helpline is your direct line to the support and advice you need. Whatever your inquiry, the RNIB helpline team are only a call away, with practical and emotional support so you can face the future with confidence. Our friendly, specially trained operators are just a phone call away from 8:45 a.m. and to 5:30 p.m. every weekday. We can help with information on everything you need to know about the RNIB, from eye health, advice on how to volunteer, reading services and loads more, or we can simply offer a listening ear. The RNIB helpline, here for you on 0303 123 9999. That's 0303 123 9999.
You're listening to Read On Air, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. And coming up, a classic short story written by a blind author. But first, both Harriet Lane novels, Alice Always and Her, have been runaway successes, but she only became an author because of a career break brought on by her sight loss, as our reporter Ellie Jacobs found out when Harriet came to the RNIB studios.
You were a journalist for many years before you were an author, and I actually think that comes across in both the novels. Both protagonists are observers to some extent, onlookers. Mm. Do you think that's a quality that either many journalists have or that you picked up as a journalist and that helped you to write?
Well, I was a features journalist. I did a lot of interviews. I was always interested in people. And so that's quite a sort of specific skill set. In a way, it's quite different from being a news journalist. I wouldn't know how to write a news story.
Yeah.
But I was always interested in people and, you know, and if I could get into their houses, that was always, you know, it happened less and less. I kind of gave up journalism in 2005. But before that, I was working at various newspapers. And before that, I was at Tatler. And, you know, and you used to get amazing access. You know, I remember going through Elizabeth Hurley's bathroom cabinet. But getting to people's houses says so much about them. And so sometimes when I'm writing, I remember that sort of sensation of, because anyway, when you're reading a feature, an interview with someone, you want to know, you know, how they live, what they're like, what the stuff they choose to surround themselves, what it says about them. So, yeah, that's definitely a technique that I use in the fiction.
Obviously, there are differences between journalistic writing and writing fiction. Do you think there are any similarities?
I mean, it's kind of weird, because I suppose with journalism, you've got a very short space of time to convey information, and you can't afford to be to leave things up to the reader. Whereas with fiction, I think that's what I like to do, is to kind of leave enough space for the readers to fill in the gaps so that you feel kind of engaged as a reader. That's essential with my fiction, I think. In terms of, I think, yes, both are about conveying character. That's really, I think, what my journalism was about. Mm. And I think it's the same with my fiction. I think the fiction is all about, it's less about plot and it's all about character.
I really like the way that you delve so deeply into the character's psyches, especially in Her, where the novel continually shifts between Emma and Nina's perspectives. Did you find it difficult to write from both their perspectives, almost about similar events, but told through such different lenses?
That's a good question. No, actually, I remember the sort of feeling of realising that it was a sort of accelerant almost to the writing, because I'd have a scene and the story's written from the perspective of Emma, who is a kind of, she's embroiled, she's with her young family, she's lost her career, really, she's put it on hold, or she has her young children at home. She's missing her career. She's finding herself sort of struggling to find a new identity. And then there's Nina, who's the same age, but at a very different sort of stage of life. Her child is much older, in some ways kind of doesn't need her so much. And so Nina's at a loose end. She's very successful creatively, but you get this sense that she's trying to find a way to fill that gap, perhaps, that her daughter's absence has left her with. So you'd have a scene written from Emma's perspective, and then you could flip it and come at it from Nina's perspective. And so you, again, it's like having, I had the framework and all I had to do was to write the character into that framework. And it was really, it felt like a very fast way to write, because I'd have the plot and then I could reproduce it. It drives some people, some readers nuts, I know. They kind of go, oh, so, you know, it's difficult, you know, dreary going through the same thing again. But actually, there is so much difference to the way that the two people experience the same events, which I think is really, tells you a great deal about them as individuals.
Yeah, definitely. I completely agree with that. Also, I found I was so gripped because, you know, you were heading to the climax, but you didn't know from whose perspective it was going to be.
Yeah, it's true. And also, there's a kind of thrill, isn't there, in seeing how something which seems so innocent to one person, you suddenly realise when you read the other alternative version, you go, oh, so that was going on all the time, you know, and you didn't necessarily see it immediately.
Completely. You really see the layers. Get beneath the veneer that people kind of try and give across.
It's true, isn't it? I mean, and, you know, I'm sure you've had the same experience of talking about an evening out with friends or an encounter or something, and you have these conversations and you realise they see something, you know, they've missed it all, or they saw something completely different. And it's really weird. It's like, that's just the way that people are. You know, we all see different stuff.
Yeah. As well as that, there's a very strong sense of place in your books that clearly reflects your life in North London. Reminded me of Zadie Smith, almost how she kind of really encapsulates London and especially North London. Do you think that any of your acquaintances would recognise themselves in your works?
Oh, my goodness. Well, actually, weirdly, I've had sort of various people have come at me quite cross, good friends or even family members have come at me quite cross saying, oh, how could you do that? And it's just totally taken me there. They've seen themselves in a character. Or in a setup, it's just, both times it absolutely floored me, because it totally is not, you know, I don't recognise it when I read it. I think there's a sort of weird hunger sometimes for people to see themselves reflected back. But oddly, the people who are in it have not said anything. Possibly they just haven't read the books. So that's fine. I won't say any more about that because I'll get into trouble.
And how do you write? Do you write every day? Do you have any rituals? Do you have to go to a special place in the woods to write?
Special place in the woods? No, I wish I did have a special place in the woods, because then I'd be having probably more fun than I am at the moment. Actually, weirdly, I think I do have a study at home. It's so boring in there. It's really dull in my study. Plus, it's next door to the bathroom where the washing machine is. So I always feel this sort of terrible obligation / procrastination urge to go and do lots of laundry instead of writing. So kind of my study's useless. I do well in coffee shops, actually. There's something about, I think, because I like being surrounded by a sense of kind of life going on. I like the hubbub. I think it's probably connected to the fact that I used to work in lots of open plan newspaper offices. So, but I mean, I'm sort of in search for the, my life is sort of endless quest for the perfect coffee shop where I can just be left to get on with it.
And I read that you did a creative writing course. Were you at all into creative writing before? Did you write fiction?
I'd done a lot. I used to write a lot of stories at school and I loved it. And then as you get older, there's not really a space for it on the curriculum. And I got into journalism, which sort of seemed to scratch the itch that I had to write. And then that just took up all my time. And I thought that was all, and that kept me happy. And then in 2005, out of the blue, I started to lose my sight with a sort of to an autoimmune disorder. And there was a period of uncertainty when no one knew really what was happening. I was just in and out of hospitals a lot, having tests and treatments and things. And at that time, I parked the freelance journalism. At that point, I was freelancing mostly for The Guardian. So I rang up all my commissioning editors and said, I can't do any work for you at the moment, and I'll let you know when I'm sort of back on the circuit. And so as well as suddenly finding myself ill, I was also dealing with the fact that I was no longer writing, and it was a big ache. After a while, I had nothing in my life apart from worry, and I needed to get out of my head. So I was really frightened, but I saw a little flyer for a lunchtime course, and it was, you know, I don't know, I turned up the first day, I was absolutely petrified, because I knew, I think I probably knew at some deep level that I really wanted to enjoy this. I wasn't thinking that it was going to be and the change that it subsequently turned out to be. I was hopeful, I was fearful, because I suspected maybe I wouldn't be able to do it. I just needed somewhere, I think, to take, to try and write again. And I remember that we had, you know, it was me and some retired people and a really good young American teacher. She gave us a writing exercise just to write for 5 minutes on a subject. I think she gave us the word cotton. She said, just write whatever comes into your head. And I can't remember what I wrote, but I can remember the feeling of sort of excitement and relief again. For me, it is a pleasure when it's working, or even when it's not. Just writing often feels, it's just, I find it very, makes me happy.
The RNIB has an annual writing competition, and each year one thing that comes up is how hard it is for partially sighted authors to edit their own works. Is it more difficult to edit your own work?
What, kind of actually physically?
Yeah, physically.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good point, because it's often, yeah, you're right, no one's ever asked me that before. I do find it's frustrating, because reading, yeah, I mean, dealing with page proofs and going back and finding things. Obviously, if you're on the computer, you can search, and that's so fast and fantastic. But yeah, when it actually comes down to printing out and going over page proofs, so slow and laborious. That's at quite a late stage, I suppose. The actual editing process of self-editing, which happens before you submit the book. I know I'm slower. I'm just a slower reader than I used to be. Everything is just that much harder. But sometimes it makes you more painstaking, which can be a good thing. You don't rush. Can't afford to rush, you know. And when I read a book now, I really am reading every word, which I know I didn't, you know, that wasn't always the way. I used to kind of skim read a lot, because you can do that. You can just run your eye over a page and absorb lots of information. But if less information is getting through, you just have to slow down and be that much more sort of diligent. I think it's probably made me a better reader.
And how do you write? Do you write on a computer? Do you write with a pen?
What, yeah, no, on a computer. I mean, the illuminated screen is a fantastic thing. No, I don't write anything by longhand. My handwriting's getting worse and worse.
Do you listen to audiobooks?
You know, I'm ashamed to say I don't. I've got really into podcasts, so I'm kind of I feel like I'm in transition. There's something about, and I know it's a prejudice, and I've talked to enough people who are evangelical about audiobooks, which are obviously undergoing such a huge sort of renaissance, you know, within the wider community. I think when I'm reading, I like that sense of a voice kind of emerging in my own head, mm-hmm. something that emerges as you sort of get deeper into the book, the character becomes clear. I'm sort of scared about handing that over to someone else, but I understand that the right reader brings a lot. So I feel like I'm on the brink of committing and starting to, I think I have to find the right book and the right narrator, the right reader, and then go for it.
Do you think that you will always have women as your protagonists? Is that something you're conscious
of? Good question, Ellie. Do you know what? I think so. I think maybe that's partly what I've been realising over the last year or so. Just, I've got to, you know, I know these women. Mm. They're familiar to me. There's lots to say about them, you know, these lives. So I think kind of difficult women, I think that's my bread and butter. Yeah, I'm going to stick with them.
I think that's what drew me so much towards the book as well. It's always great having a female.
And problematic people who aren't straightforward or good, you know. I remember ages ago, long time ago, reading a Barbara Vine, you know, maybe this was 20 years ago. And this kind of thrill when I realised that the narrator was, it was a slow reveal. There's a lot that you take for granted when you're reading a book, and I think I played on that a lot with the Alice Always character. You know, you assume quite a lot. You assume you're in good hands. You assume that you're the person who's telling you the truth is being straightforward with you. And then that's what I realised with the Barbara Vine. It's like, oh, okay. Maybe it was a third of the way into the book, and I suddenly thought, oh my gosh, I thought you were like this, but you're not at all. I love that sort of slippage.
Thanks to Ellie and to Harriet Lane. Alice Always is available in a range of formats from the RNIB library, including as TB22918. Her is TB23257. You're listening to Read On Air on RNIB Connect Radio. And still to come, Joanna Trollope will be telling us about her passion for talking books. But first, it's time for that hidden gem, My World and Welcome to It by James Thurber. Some of the most famous names in literature were blind: Homer, Milton, Joyce and Borges. They all suffered sight loss, but in most cases it only improved their writing. Whether it's coincidence that they're all rather heavyweight literary authors is up for debate. If you'd like to find out for yourself, then there's a wide selection of their work available in various accessible forms from the RNIB library. And believe me, having Ulysses narrated to you is much easier than having to read it yourself. By contrast, the author I'm talking about today is light reading, but the gems in his books sparkle just as brightly. James Thurber was 7 when he was blinded by an arrow in a game of William Tell with his brother. He lost the sight in one eye completely and was left with limited and failing vision in the other. But this didn't stop him from becoming one of the most popular and respected humorists of the 20th century. Known as the Mark Twain of his era, his stories, essays and cartoons set the standard for a generation of other American writers. And over 50 years after Thurber's death, they are still funny and fascinating. He's best known for the classic, surreal short story, The Secret Life of Walter Mitty, which is the opening story in My World and Welcome to It, a brilliant collection of Thurber's writing that I downloaded from the library via Overdrive.
The crew, bending to their various tasks in the huge, hurtling 8-engine Navy hydroplane, looked at each other and grinned. "Yeah, the old man'll get us through," they said to one another. "The old man ain't afraid of hell."
"Not so fast. You're driving too fast," said Mrs. Mitty. "What are you driving so fast for?"
"Hmm?" said Walter Mitty. He looked at his wife in the seat beside him with shocked astonishment. She seemed grossly unfamiliar, like a strange woman who had yelled at him in a crowd.
"You were up to 55," she said. "You know I don't like to go more than 40. You were up to 55.
Like many of the other stories in this volume, The Secret Life of Walter Mitty is a combination of the humdrum and the absurd. Thurber's world is a joyous mix of the familiar and the surreal that always reminds me of part animated films like Who Framed Roger Rabbit. The characters and situations he creates are liable to pop out into a comic book dimension at any moment, giving the reader a glimpse of just how petty and dull day-to-day lives can appear sometimes. The collection also contains a wonderfully silly and very clever spoof on Shakespeare in the Macbeth murder mystery. and a story called Interview with a Lemming that is as wry and relevant now as it was in 1942. If there's a theme that runs through the majority of the 22 stories contained in the first part of My World and Welcome to It, it's man's ability to be driven to distraction by small, seemingly innocuous things. For the most part, this takes the form of laughing along with the frustrations of ordinary people, as in the story The Preoccupation of Mr. Pettifoss.
In a time when everything should be made as simple and uncomplicated as possible, the Connecticut Telephone Company has taken to changing a lot of peaceful old rural phone numbers, which have been doing all right the way they were. Now, lots worse things have happened to me, but not many that I keep thinking about more often.
But this collection also contains two of the darkest stories that Thurber ever wrote, A Friend to Alexander and The Whippoorwill, the latter a chilling horror about the psychological effects of repetitive birdsong.
It slowly carved out a recurring nightmare in which Kinstry was attacked by an umbrella whose handle, when you clutched it, clutched right back. For the umbrella was not an umbrella at all, but a raven. Through the gloomy hallways of his mind rang the thing's dolorous cry, "Nevermore, nevermore, nevermore, Whippoorwill, Whippoorwill."
Sometimes I wonder if this awareness of how thin the line between absurdity and madness is gives us an insight into Thurber's mind. His crazy cartoon world is very funny, till it's not. Walter Mitty's fantasies border on the schizophrenic. Like many people who are severely sight-impaired, Thurber suffered from hallucinations caused by Charles Bonnet syndrome. These take the form of often very weird figures. For the most part, they are benign, but in some cases they can be deeply disturbing and make it difficult to distinguish between what's real and what's illusion. When, in The Whippoorwill, Kinstry snaps, "There's nothing in life to be sure about," I wonder if that's Thurber speaking. The second part of My World and Welcome to It consists of an 8-chapter comic memoir about the time Thurber spent in France shortly after World War I. They're a lovely evocation of a bygone age, but lack the punch of the other stories in the volume. All in all, I think that Thurber's writing, like that of Homer, Milton, Joyce and Borges, acquired an additional dimension because of his sight loss. It's a sense of something invisible and uncertain that sharpens his observations. My Life and Welcome to It contains some of his best work, and the talking book version, read by William Roberts, is TB10156. Do you have a favourite book in the library that you'd like to tell us about? Or maybe a title that would expand my reading horizons? Why not drop us a line by emailing readonair@rnib.org.uk. We'd love to hear from you.
Talking Books.
In the Talking Books Library.
"They've found her, my lord!" Ned rose quickly. "Omen or Lannisters?" "It was Jory." Daenerys Targaryen wed Khal Drogo with fear and barbaric splendor in a field beyond the walls of Pentos. The North went on forever. Tyrion Lannister knew the maps as well as anyone. But a fortnight on the wild track that passed for the King's Road up here had brought home the lesson that the map was one thing and the land quite another.
Game of Thrones by George R.R. Martin. Book 1 in A Song of Ice and Fire.
The courtyard rang to the sound of swords. Under black wool, boiled leather and mail, sweat trickled icily down John's chest as he pressed the attack.
Narrated by Tom Carter, it lasts 35 hours and 2 minutes. Talking book number 19231.
"Tell Jory to bring her here at once." "I am sorry, my lord," Poole told him. "The guards on the gate were Lannister men, and they informed the queen when Jory brought her in. She's been taken directly before the king."
Also available are A Clash of Kings, A Storm of Swords, A Feast for Crows, and A Dance with Dragons. And many of them you can buy as a Daisy CD. For more information, head to www.rnib.org.uk.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
Joanna Trollope is best known as the author of novels such as The Choir and The Rector's Wife that have won her a huge international following. Less well known is her passionate support of RNIB Talking Books. Leanne Coyle discovered more.
I'm Joanna Trollope, and I've written, I think, about 17 or 18 modern novels and some historical novels and one volume of non-fiction, which is called Britannia's Daughters, which is about the opportunities that were offered to Victorian women by the British Empire. And I've been writing, do you know, it's forever, I suddenly realise. I've been writing since my youngest was 3 and she is now 42. And I started writing at school. I've got a novel somewhere under lock and key, which I wrote when I was 14, about the kind of teenager I wished I was instead of the one I actually was. Yeah.
Well, that's quite interesting. Now that you've revealed that, I'm sure it would be quite sought after, that novel that you wrote when you were 14. Quite famously, you were asked to rewrite Sense and Sensibility. Was that an intimidating task for you?
Well, it's not rewriting it, really. It's just updating it. And what I've done with Sense and Sensibility, which I don't think was the first Jane Austen I read, I expect that was Pride and Prejudice, which I would have read when I was about 13, I expect, and then Sense and Sensibility. And the brief was to take Jane Austen's characters, Jane Austen's narrative, her story, and in my case, I wanted to take Jane Austen's attitude to her characters and just transpose them from 1809, when the book was first published, to 2013. And, you know, I started being a great fan of Jane Austen and I ended up thinking she was an absolute genius, because when she wrote Sense and Sensibility, the novel as a genre was only at most 50 years old, half a century old. It was a brand new way of writing. You know, drama and poetry had always been the great genres. And suddenly fiction, here it was, this brand new genre. And she understood instinctively, sitting in her father's parsonage in Hampshire, a very secluded life, really, although it was quite busy in its own way, domestically and socially. She understood that the great themes, particularly for romantic fiction, were romantic love, money and class. And she's put those into her 6 books. And here we are still at it, hundreds of years later. It's really astonishing.
You must have been honoured to have been asked to tackle that
task. Oh, hugely.
Val McDermid, who updated Northanger Abbey, she mentioned about today's communication speeds differing.
They do.
How did you combat this?
Oh, I simply put modern technology into the book, because the story and the characters translate absolutely seamlessly to 2013. You know, Willoughby's a kind of trustafarian love rat, but he can't have a horse, obviously, in this day and age, so he has an Aston Martin. And, you know, Nancy Steele, you know, the awful Steele sisters. Nancy Steele is straight out of The Only Way Is Essex. You know, there was a slot for every single character, which just shows how timeless they were. And, of course, modern communication, I think Val's absolutely right. Modern communication is a problem. So is the fact that everybody was so leisured then and seemed to have lots of money. Well, they had lots of money, I'm sorry to say, because the great commodity in Jane Austen's period was sugar. Sugar was new and it was enormous. It's difficult to describe how crucial. It was even more prevalent than coffee and coffee shops are now.
Wow.
And, of course, the sugar trade was closely allied to the slave trade. So Mr. Bingley in Pride and Prejudice, why is he, age 24, so leisured with nothing to do except fidget about between Netherfield Park and London? Because his family were involved in the slave trade. The Austin family were abolitionists, but we mustn't sort of sugarcoat Jane Austen. We mustn't see her as looking like the lid of a tin of Quality Street. You know, it's not sweetly pretty, sprigged muslin life. It's robust, quite harsh, Georgian life.
You know, moving on to some of your other books, A Passionate Man is about to be recorded here at the Talking Books.
I'm thrilled to have that. Yes. I think the whole Talking Book scheme, in whatever form it is absolutely fantastic.
And what does it mean to you to have your work made accessible to people who can't just, you know, pick up and read a hardback or paperback
copy? I mean, an infinite amount, because I think in this day and age, modern medicine is so clever and so sophisticated, and we spend an enormous amount of time and energy and enthusiasm saving lives. But what the Talking Books do, and what the RNIB, I think, does in general, is save sanities before, you know, you get to the end of your life. I mean, the number of people whose lives have been transformed by Talking Books. I mean, the number of people who are visually impaired or blind who say that, their lives have been absolutely changed. This is a lifeline. It's impossible to emphasise how important that is. And I was noticing on the tube coming up here this morning that it was a very full carriage because it was that time of day, and I would have said that 3/4 of the people in the carriage were reading. Very few on screens. There were lots of people, obviously, with their phones, but most people were reading books and newspapers. But even if you're reading your phone, you're reading print. Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, the important thing is to get across how we take it for granted in such a way. You've got to imagine what it's like walking about with a blindfold on all the time.
Would you say that you're a massive supporter of RNIB?
Very much so.
And would you say that is one of the main reasons why the charity is so close to your heart?
It is. It's partly story and reading and accessibility to books and the access to the possibilities of one's imagination and one's mind. It's because we've all got to live with the insides of our own heads. And if you are driven back without any outside stimulus, you've just got your own powers. You can go a bit crackers. You know, this expands your imaginative world in an extraordinary way. I am extremely short-sighted. I mean, without contact lenses, I would be stumbling about. I think I'm -8 in one eye and -6.5 in the other. And I've been in contact lenses for 40 years. And now they're these wonderful soft things. So I can identify very intensely with how it feels to need the stimulus of reading and not be able to access it.
You technically are, I don't know if you know, about partially sighted.
Yes, I am.
So it's no wonder you can relate. Your latest book, Joanna, is a balancing act. If you can tell us a bit about this, it will eventually become a talking book.
I'm so excited to hear that. I'm delighted. Now, this book, Balancing Act, is about a very interesting and, for a lot of men, rather upsetting new statistic, which is that in this country, I think 25%, maybe slightly more, women earn more than the men they live with. And it's just going to go up.
That's a statistic.
It is. Yes, it is. Okay. And this is a novel about a woman who founded a company. Well, she revived her grandfather's company. And her 3 daughters, grown-up daughters, work in the company with her. It's a pottery. I got to know Stoke-on-Trent extremely well. I wanted a muscular industry. I didn't want to sort of faff about with scented candles and things. I wanted an industry that women are in, but is quite physical, mm-hmm. as it were, and in a deprived area as well, as the 6 towns have rather sadly become. And I did lots of research in Stoke-on-Trent, obviously, because I always do research for all the books, so that the background of the books is as authentic as I can possibly get it. So this woman has... She's called Susie Sullivan. That's what the pottery is called, Susie Sullivan, because when I was growing up, there was a very famous pottery called Susie Cooper. A lot of the people listening will remember Susie Cooper. And she was one of the first sort of names in English pottery. And this is more like Emma Bridgewater. This is more the sort of spongeware. You know, the revival of the idea of kitchen domestic bliss and cosiness and crumpets, you know? Cupcakes.
Yes, I can yes. imagine, yeah.
And so this is a novel about what it's like running a company, about what it's like working with your family, because that's not the same as working with people you're not related to, and crucially, the effect these women have on the men in their lives and their children.
And would you say then that this is a book of the times, really?
Yes.
There's a lot of talk still about this glass ceiling, about women not ever being able to reach the same pay scale as men. And that seems to be the problem that we all talk about, and it's drummed into us. But actually, this is quite a new statistic, that 25% of women earn more than their partners.
It's to counteract, you know, books like this one that's in the New York Times bestseller list about being a subservient slave to your husband. Is it called The Good Wife's Handbook or something?
There is not quite one of that ilk, yes. I can't quite remember the name.
Where you just subsume yourself into your husband's dominant personality. It makes me absolutely gibber. But I think the equality people are talking about, there are some astonishingly successful, high-flying women. But the thing is, there's this enormous sector of rather second-rate men who, you know, earn more than women who are possibly more qualified than they are. And that's where the equality really applies, in the realm of the perhaps the mediocre rather than the utterly gifted, which, you know, we can't all possibly be. But it's a question of attitudes, and it's a question of fear, because people are terrified of change. Of course they are, because every change involves some little sacrifice. It's quite difficult.
You mentioned Jane Austen paving the way as a novelist, as a female novelist herself, but how have you found it in your career as a female writer? You're obviously very successful, but did you ever come up against any brick walls where you felt your gender was something to do with that?
Yes. I don't imagine that my advances matched the male equivalent even 15 years ago. And there's no question but that men's books get reviewed like two-thirds to a third books written by women in this country. The attention they get in terms of criticism and promotion. But over 65%, about 67% of the books bought in this country are bought by women, and women are the mainstay of most book groups, and women give books as presents. Women are very, very into sharing with books. I think we'll get there. I think it's just taking a very, very long time.
Well, that brings me on nicely to ask you what advice you would give to, well, not only the women listening, but anyone listening who would like to write, novels or stories. What makes a good writer?
I think it's knowledge of humanity. So for somebody sighted, I would obviously say, train your powers of observation. You can't say that to someone whose sight is not perfect. So it's a question of using what they've learned from their own lives and what they've learned from talking books to deepen their understanding of the details of humanity, the little things that make people what they are, make people behave in the way they do. Because really, the absolutely crucial element of all fiction is the knowledge, understanding, variety and non-judgment of humanity. That's what makes a book real. So it's a question of, if you're deciding upon a personality or a character in a book, you mightn't give them an excuse for behaving how they are, but it's always a good idea to give them a reason, because there'll be somebody out there who identifies with their situation. I'm not really a great fan of the school of writing what you know, i.e. I don't know about drawing on your own life all the time, because I often feel that's rather unfair on the other people involved in your life. But I think a story, you can often work a story backwards. But it's a question of, as it were, keeping a mental notebook of human behaviour, human codes of conduct, human characteristics. And the more you can learn about humanity, the more successful your fiction will be.
Yeah, I guess, and the more believable the characters will be.
Very much so.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for supporting RNIB. We'll obviously let the listeners know once A Passionate Man is available in
audio. I'm very excited about that.
Yes, and thank you. Thank you for your time today, Joanna Trollope.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks to Leanne and to Joanna Trollope. A huge selection of her books, including that retelling of Sense and Sensibility, can be found in the RNIB library. Just go to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999 and select option 5. So that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to Mark, Harriet, Ellie and Joanna, and to everyone who's been in touch about your book groups, the titles you've been enjoying and ideas for books that I should read. Read On Air will be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, you can find all our past shows, complete with some exclusive author interviews, book reviews and more, on our Audioboom page. Simply head to audioboom.com and search for RNIB, where you'll find Read On Air and other great content from RNIB Connect Radio. So until next week, thanks for listening and remember to read on.